me. She would not leave my side. "I am a British journalist," she said. "Anything you do to this woman, I will report it." The military police were uncertain, so they called their commander. The commander came in a camouflage uniform and a red beret, with tribal scars on his cheeks. He looked at my deportation document, and he looked at me and Sarah and Charlie. He stood there for a long time, scratching his belly and nodding.
"Why is the child dressed in this fashion?" he said.
Sarah looked straight back at him. She said, "The child believes he has special powers." The commander grinned.
"Well, I am just a man," he said. "I will not arrest any of you this time."
Everybody laughed, but the military police followed our taxi from the airport. I was very frightened, but Sarah gripped my hand. "I will not leave you," she said. "So long as Charlie and I are here, you are safe." The police waited outside our hotel. We stayed there for 2 weeks, and so did they. The window of our room looked out over Abuja. Tall buildings stretched back for miles, tall and clean, some covered in silver glass that reflected the long, straight boulevards. I watched the city as the sunset made the buildings glow red, and then I watched all night. I could not sleep. When the sun rose, it shone between the horizon and the base of the clouds. It blazed on the golden dome of the mosque, while the four tall towers were still lit up with electric lights. It was beautiful. Sarah came out onto the balcony of our room, and she found me standing there and staring. "This is your city," she said. "Are you proud?" I did not know such a thing existed in my country. I am still trying to feel that it is mine. I stood there all morning, while the heat of the day grew stronger and the streets grew busy with car taxis and scooter taxis and walking sellers with their swaying racks of t-shirts and headscarves and medicine. Charlie sat inside, watching cartoons with the air conditioning on, and Sarah laid out all of Andrew's papers on a long, low table. On each pile of papers we placed a shoe or a lamp or a glass to stop them blowing in the breeze from the big mahogany fans that spun on the ceiling. Sarah explained how she was going to write the book that Andrew had been researching. "I need to collect more stories like yours," she said. "Do you think we can do that here, without going down to the south of the country?" I did not answer. I looked through some of the papers, and then I went and stood on the balcony again. Sarah came and stood beside me. "What is it?" she said. I nodded my head down at the military police car waiting on the street below. Two men leaned against it, in green uniforms with berets and sunglasses. One of them looked up. He said something when he saw us, and his colleague looked up too. They stared up at our balcony for a long time, and then they lit cigarettes and sat in the car, one in the front seat and one in the back seat, with the doors open and their heavy boots resting on the tarmac. "You know, it is not a good idea to collect stories," I said. Sarah shook her head. "I don't agree. I think it's the only way we'll make you safe." "What do you mean?" Sarah lifted her eyes up from the street. "Our problem is that you have only your own story. One story makes you weak, but as soon as we have 100 stories, you will be strong. If we can show that what happened to your village happened to 100 villages, then the power is on our side. We need to collect the stories of people who've been through the same things as you. We need to make it undeniable. Then we can send the stories to a lawyer, and will let the authorities know if anything happens to you. Those stories will go straight to the media. Do you see? I think that was what Andrew hoped to do with his book. It was his way of saving girls like you. I shrugged. What if the authorities are not afraid of the media?
Sarah nodded slowly.
That's a possibility, she said. I don't know. What do you think? I looked out across the towers of Abuja. The great building shimmered in the heat as if they were insubstantial, as if they could be awoken from and forgotten with a splash of cold water to the face. I do not know, I said. I do not know how things are in my country. Until I was 14 years old, my country was 3 cassava fields and a limba tree. And after that, I was in yours. So do not ask me how my country works.
Hmm, said Sarah.
She waited for a minute, and then she said,
So what do you want us to do?
I looked again at the city we saw from that balcony. I saw for the first time how much space there was in it. There were wide gaps between the city blocks. I thought these dark green squares were parks and gardens, but now I saw that they were just empty spaces, waiting for something to be built. Abuja was a city that was not finished. This was very interesting to me, to see that my capital city had these green squares of hope built into it, to see how my country carried its dreams in a see-through bag. I smiled at Sarah. Let us go and collect the stories.
You're sure?
I want to be part of my country's story. I pointed out into the heat. See, they have left space for me. Sarah held on to my hand very tight.
All right, she said.
But, Sarah...
Yes?
There is one story I must tell you first. I told Sarah what happened when Andrew died. The story was hard to hear, and it was hard to tell. Afterward, I went back inside the hotel room, and she stayed out on the balcony on her own. I sat down on the bed with Charlie, and he watched cartoons, while I watched Sarah's shoulder shaking. The next day we started our work. Early in the morning, Sarah walked out into the street, and she gave a very large amount of money to the military policeman waiting outside the hotel. After this, their eyes were the eyes of the faces on the banknotes that Sarah gave them. They saw nothing but the inside of the military police car's glove box and the lining of the policeman's uniform pockets. The policeman's only rule was, we had to be back at the hotel before sunset each evening. My job was to find people who would normally be scared to talk to a foreign journalist, but who talked to Sarah because I promised them that she was a good person. These were people who believed what I told them because my story was the same as theirs. I discovered there were a lot of us in my country, people who had seen things the oil companies wished we had not seen. People the government would prefer to be silent. We went all around the southeast of my country in an old white Peugeot, just like the one that my father used to have. I sat in the passenger seat and Sarah drove, with Charlie smiling and laughing in the back. We listened to the music on the local radio stations, turned up very loud. The red dust from the road blew everywhere, even inside the car. And when we took off Charlie's Batman suit to wash him at the end of each day, his white skin had 2 bright red diamonds on it where the eye holes of his mask had been. Sometimes I got scared. Sometimes when we arrived in a village,
I saw the way some of the men looked at me, and I remembered how me and my sister were hunted. I wondered if there was still money from the oil companies for anyone who would shut my mouth for once and all. I was scared of the village men, but Sarah just smiled. "Relax," she said. "Remember what happened at the airport? Nothing's going to happen to you so long as I'm here." And I did begin to relax. In each village I found people with stories, and Sarah wrote them down. It was easy. We started to be happy. We thought we had done enough to save ourselves. We thought, this is a good trick. One night when we had been in my country for 2 weeks, I dreamed of my sister in Kiruka. She walked up out of the sea. First the surface of the water swirled from the movement of something unseen, and then, in the hollow between two waves, I saw the top of her head with white foam dancing around it. Then my sister's face rose above the water, and slowly she walked up the beach toward me, and she stood there, smiling, and wearing the Hawaiian shirt that I was wearing when they released me from detention. It was soaked with salt water. My sister spoke my name once, and then she waited. When Sarah woke up, I went to her. "Please," I said, "we have got to go to the sea. I must say goodbye to my sister." Sarah looked at me for a long time, and then she nodded. We did not say anything. That morning, Sarah gave the policeman much more money than before. We drove south to Benin City, and we got there in the late afternoon. We stayed overnight in another hotel that was just the same, and the next morning we drove south again to the coast. We left early, when the sun was still low in the sky and the light shining into the car windows was warm and golden. Charlie sighed and banged his heels on the back seat.
"Is we nearly there yet?" he said.
Sarah smiled at him in the rearview mirror.
"Nearly, darling," she said. The road ran out at one of the fishing villages they have in that place, and we stepped down onto the sand. Charlie laughed and ran down the beach to make sandcastles. I sat on the beach next to Sarah, and we looked out over the ocean. There was no sound, except for the waves breaking on the beach. After a long time, Sarah turned to me. She said, "I'm proud we've come this far." I took her hand. "You know, Sarah, since I left my country, often I think to myself, how would I explain these things to the girls back home?" Sarah laughed and stretched her hands along the beach in both directions.
"Well," said Sarah, "how would you explain this to the girls back home? I mean, this would take some explaining, wouldn't you say?"
I shook my head. "I would not explain this to the girls back home."
"No?"
"No, Sarah, because today I am saying goodbye to all that. We are the girls back home now, you and me. There is nothing else for me to go back to. I do not need to tell this story to anyone else. Thank you for saving me, Sarah." When I said this, I saw that Sarah was crying, and then I was crying too. When the day became hotter, the beach filled up with people. There were fishermen who walked out into the waves and sent wide, bright nets spinning out before them, and there were old men who came to sit and look at the sea, and mothers who brought their children to splash in the water. "We should go and ask these people if anyone has a story," I said. Sarah smiled and pointed at Charlie.
"Yes, but it can wait," she said.
"Look, he's having such fun."
Charlie was running and laughing, and I can tell you that a dozen of the local children were running with him and laughing and shouting, because if there is one thing you do not see very often on the beach in my country, it is a white superhero less than 1 meter in height with sand and salt water on his cape. Charlie was laughing with the other children, running and playing and chasing. It was hot, and I dug my toes down into the cooler sand. "Sarah," I said, "how long do you think you will stay?" "I don't know. Do you want to try coming with me to England? We could try to get you papers this time." I shrugged. "They do not want people like me." Sarah smiled. "I'm English, and I want people like you. Surely I'm not the only one." "People will say you are naive." Sarah smiled. "Let them," she said. "Let them say whatever gives them comfort." We sat for a long time and watched the sea. In the afternoon, the sea breeze blew and I fell asleep for a little while, half in and half out of the shade of the trees at the top of the beach. The sun warmed my blood until I could not keep my eyes open, and the sea roared in and out, and my breathing slipped into time with the waves as I began to dream. I dreamed we all stayed together in my country. I was happy. I dreamed I was a journalist, telling the stories of my country, and we all lived in the same house, me and Charlie and Sarah, in a tall, cool three-story house in Abuja. It was a very beautiful home. It was the sort of place I never even dreamed of back in the days when our Bible ended at the 27th chapter of Matthew. I was happy in this house that I dreamed of, and the cook and the housekeeper smiled at me and called me princess. Early each morning the garden boy brought me a scented yellow rose for my hair, trembling on its fine green stem with the dew of the night still on it. There was a carved wood veranda painted white and a long curved garden with bright flowers and dark shade. I travelled through my country and I listened to stories of all kinds. Not all of them were sad. There were beautiful stories that I found. There was horror, yes, but there was joy in them too. The dreams of my country are no different from yours. They are as big as the human heart. In my dream, Lawrence telephoned Sarah to ask when she was coming home. Sarah looked across the veranda at Charlie playing with his building blocks, and she smiled and she said, "What do you mean? We are home." It was the sound of the surf pounding on the beach that woke me. Crash, like the drawer of a cash register springing open and all the coins inside it smashing against the edge of their compartments. The surf pounded and ebbed, the cash drawer opened and closed. There is a moment when you wake up from dreaming in the hot sun, a moment outside time when you do not know what you are. At first, because you feel absolutely free, as if you could transform yourself into anything at all, it seems that you must be money. But then you feel the hot breath of something on your face, and it seems that, no, you are not money. You must be that hot breeze blowing in from the sea. It seems that the heaviness you feel in your limbs is the weight of the salt in the wind, and the sweet sleepiness that bewitches you is simply the weariness that comes from the day and night pushing of waves across the ocean. But next you realize that no, you are not the breeze. In fact, you can feel sand drifting up against your bare skin. And for an instant, you are the sand that the breeze blows up the beach, just one grain of sand among the billions of blown grains. How nice to be inconsequential.
How pleasant to know that there is nothing to be done. How sweet simply to go back to sleep, as the sand does, until the wind thinks to awaken it again. But then you understand that no, you are not the sand, because this skin that the sand drifts up against, this skin is your own. Well then, you are a creature with skin, and what of it? It is not as if you are the first creature that fell asleep under the sun, listening to the sound of waves pounding. A billion fishes have slipped away like this, flapping on the blinding white sand, and what difference will one more make? But the moment carries on, and you are not a fish dying. In fact, you are not even truly sleeping. And so you open your eyes and look down on yourself, and you say, "Ah, so I am a girl then, an African girl. This is what I am, and this is how I will stay," as the shape-changing magic of dreams whispers back into the roar of the ocean. I sat up and blinked and looked around. A white woman was sitting next to me on the beach in the thing called shade, and I remembered that the white woman's name was Sarah. I saw her face, her wide eyes staring away down the beach. She looked. I searched for the name of her expression in your language. She looked frightened.
"Oh my God," Sarah was saying, "I think we need to get away from here."
I smiled sleepily. "Yes, yes," I was thinking, "we always need to get away from here. Wherever here is, there is always a good reason to get away from it. That is the story of my life, always running, 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 without one single moment of peace. Sometimes when I remember my mother and my father and my big sister Enkiruka, I think I will always be running until the day I am reunited with the dead." Sarah grabbed my hand and tried to pull me up.
"Get up, B," she said. "There are soldiers coming up the beach."
I breathed in the hot, salty smell of the sand. I sighed. I looked in the direction Sarah was staring. There were 6 soldiers. They were still a long way away along the beach. The air above the sand was so hot that it dissolved the men's legs into a shimmer, a green confusion of colors, so that the soldiers seemed to be floating toward us on a cloud made of some enchanted substance, free as the thoughts of a girl waking up from dreams on a hot beach. I screwed up my eyes against the glare, and I saw the light gleaming on the barrels of the soldiers' rifles. These rifles were more distinct than the men who carried them. They held their firm straight lines, while the men beneath them shimmered. In this way the weapons rode their men like mules, proud and gleaming in the sun, knowing that when a beast beneath them died, they would simply ride another one. This is how the future rode out to meet me in my country. The sun shone on its rifles, and it pounded on my bare head too. I could not think. It was too hot and too late in the afternoon.
"Why would they come for us here, Sarah?"
"I'm sorry, B. It's those policemen in Abuja, isn't it? I thought I'd paid them enough to close their eyes for a few days. But someone must have put the word out. I suppose they must have seen us in Sapele."
I knew it was true, but I pretended that it was not. That is a good trick. That is called saving 1 minute of the quietest part of the late afternoon while the whole of time is ending.
"Maybe the soldiers are just going for a walk by the sea, Sarah. Anyway, this is a long beach. They will not know who we are."
Sarah put her hand on my cheek
and she turned my head until I was looking in her eyes. "Look at me," she said. "Look how bloody white I am. Do you see any other women on the beach this color?"
"So?"
"They'll be looking out for a girl with a white woman and a white boy. Just walk away from us, okay, B? Go down to the point down there, where those other women are, and don't look around till the soldiers have gone. If they take me and Charlie, don't worry. There's no way they'll do anything to us."
Charlie held on to Sarah's leg and looked up at her.
"Mummy," he said, "why has little B got to go?"
"It's not for long, Batman, just until the soldiers have gone."
Charlie put his hands on his hips.
"I don't want little B to go," he said.
"She has to hide, darling," said Sarah, "just for a few minutes."
"Why?"
said Charlie. Sarah stared out to the sea, and the expression on her face was the saddest thing I ever saw. She answered Charlie, but she turned to me when she spoke.
"Because we still haven't done enough to save her, Charlie. I thought we had, but we need to do more. And we will do more, darling. We will. We won't ever give up on little B, because she is part of our family now. And until she is happy and safe, then I don't think we will be either."
Charlie held on to my leg.
"I want to go with her," he said.
Sarah shook her head. "I need you to stay and look after me, Batman." Charlie shook his head. He was not happy. I looked away down the beach. The soldiers were half a mile away. They came slowly, looking left and right, checking the faces of the people on the beach. Sometimes they stopped and did not continue on their way until someone showed them papers. I nodded slowly. "Thank you, Sarah." I walked down the slope of the beach to the hard sand where the waves were breaking. I looked out at the hazy horizon, and I followed the deep blue and indigo of the ocean from that distant line all the way to the beach, where it crashed into waves of white spray and sent its last thin sheets of water foaming and hissing up the sand to sink away to nothing in the place where my feet were standing. I saw how it ended there. The wet sand under my feet made me think of how it was when the men took me and Enkiruka away. And for the first time, I began to be fearful. I was fully awake now. I knelt down in the shore break, and I splashed the cold salt water over my head and my face until I could think clearly. Then I walked quickly along the beach to the point that Sarah had shown me. The point was 2 or 3 minutes away. A tall ridge of dark grey rock came out of the jungle there at the height of the treetops, and it ran across the sand and then out into the sea, getting shorter as it went, but still as high as 2 men at the point of the rock, where it stuck out into the surf. The waves crashed against it and sent explosions of white foam into the silver-blue sky. In the shade of the rock, it was suddenly cold, and my skin shivered when it touched the dark stone. There were some local women resting in the shade there, sitting on the hard sand with their backs against the rock, while their children played all around them, jumping over their mother's legs and running into the shore break, laughing and daring one another to go out into the white roaring foam where the great waves crashed against the point of the rock. I sat down with the other women and smiled at them. They smiled back and talked in their language, but I did not understand it. The women smelled of sweat and wood smoke. I looked back along the beach. The soldiers were close now. The women around me, they were watching the soldiers too. When the soldiers were close enough to notice the color of Sarah's skin, I saw them start to walk faster.
they stopped in front of Sarah and Charlie. Sarah stood very straight, and she stared at the soldiers with her hands on her hips. The leader of the soldiers stepped forward. He was tall and relaxed, with his rifle riding high on his shoulder and his hand scratching the top of his head. I could see he was smiling. He said something, and I watched Sarah shaking her head. The head soldier stopped smiling then. He shouted at Sarah. I heard the shout, but I could not hear what he said. Sarah shook her head again, and she pushed Charlie behind her legs. Around me, the local women were staring and saying, "Where?" But the children were still playing in the shorebreak, and they had not noticed what was occurring farther down the beach. The leader of the soldiers, he took the gun down from his shoulder, and he pointed it at Sarah. The other soldiers gathered in close, and they unslung their weapons too. The leader shouted again. Sarah just shook her head. The leader pulled back the barrel of his gun then, and I thought he was going to push it into Sarah's face. But just then, Charlie broke away, and he started to run down the beach toward the rocky point where we were sitting. He ran with his head down, and his Batman cape fluttering behind him, and at first the soldiers just laughed and watched him go. But the leader of the soldiers, he was not laughing. He shouted something at his men, and one of them raised his rifle and swung it round to point at Charlie. The women around me, they gasped. One of them screamed. It was a crazy, shocking sound. At first I thought it was a seabird right beside me, and my head snapped around to look, and when I turned back toward where Charlie was running, I saw a jet of sand flying up from the hard beach beside him. At first I did not know what it was, but then I heard the rifle shot that had made it. Then I screamed too. The soldier was swinging the barrel of his rifle, taking aim again. That was when I stood up and started to run toward Charlie. I ran so hard, my breath was burning, and I screamed at the soldiers, "Don't shoot! Don't shoot! I am the one you want!" And I ran with my eyes half closed and one hand spread out in front of my face as if that would protect me from the bullet that would come for me. I ran, cringing like a dog from the whip, but the bullet did not come. The leader of the soldiers, he shouted out an order, and his man put down his rifle. All of the soldiers stood there then, with their hands at their sides, watching. Charlie and me, we came together halfway between the rocky point and the soldiers. I knelt and I held out my arms to him. His face was twisted with terror, and I held him while he cried against my chest. I waited for the soldiers to come and get me, but they did not. The leader stood there, and he watched, and I saw the way he slung his rifle back on his shoulder and lifted his hand to scratch his head again. I saw Sarah, with her hands behind her head, pulling at her hair and screaming to be let go, while one of the soldiers restrained her. After a long time, Charlie stopped sobbing, and he turned his face up toward mine. I peeled back his Batman mask a little, so I could see his face, and he smiled at me. I smiled back at him, in that moment that the soldier's leader gave me, that 1 minute of dignity he offered me, as one human being to another, before he sent his men across the hard sand to fetch me. Here it was then, finally, the quietest part of the late afternoon. I smiled down at Charlie, and I understood that he would be free now, even if I would not. In this way, the life that was in me would find its home in him now. It was not a sad feeling. I felt my heart take off lightly like a butterfly, and I thought, yes, this is it. Something has survived in me, something that does not need to run any more, because it is worth more than all the money in the world and its currency. Its true home is the living. And not just the living in this particular country or in that particular country, but the secret, irresistible heart of the living. I smiled back at Charlie, and I knew that the hopes of this whole human world could fit inside one soul. This is a good trick. This is called globalization. Everything will be all right for you, Charlie, I said. But Charlie was not listening. Already he was giggling and kicking and struggling to be put down. He stared over my shoulder at the local children still playing in the shore break around the rocky point.
Let me go! Let me go!
I shook my head. No, Charlie, it is a very hot day. You cannot run around in your costume like that or you will boil, I am telling you, and then you will be no good to us at all to fight the baddies. Take off your Batman costume right now, and then you will just be yourself and you can go to cool off in the sea.
No.
Please, Charlie, you must. It is for your health. Charlie shook his head. I stood him in the sand and I knelt down beside him and I whispered in his ear. Charlie, I said, do you remember when I promised you, if you took off your costume, that I would tell you my real name? Charlie nodded. So, do you still want to know my real name? Charlie tilted his head to one side so that both of the ears of his mask flopped over. Then he tilted it to the other side. Then finally he looked straight at me.
What is yours real name?
He whispered. I smiled. My name is Udo.
Udo?
That is it. Udo means peace. Do you know what peace is, Charlie? Charlie shook his head. Peace is a time when people can tell each other their real names. Charlie grinned. I looked over his shoulder. The soldiers were walking across the sand toward us now. They were walking slowly, with their rifles in their hands pointing down at the sand. And while the soldiers walked, the waves rolled into the beach and crashed upon the sand one by one at this final end of their journey. The waves rolled and rolled, and there was no end to the power of them, cold enough to wake a young girl from dreams, loud enough to tell and retell the future. I bent my head, and I kissed Charlie on the forehead. He stared at me.
Udo, he said.
Yes, Charlie?
I is going to take off mine Batman costume now.
The soldiers were almost on us now.
Hurry then, Charlie, I whispered.
Charlie pulled off the mask first, and the local children gasped when they saw his blonde hair. Their curiosity was greater than their fear of the soldiers, and they ran with their skinny legs straining toward the place where we were. And then when Charlie took off the rest of his costume and they saw his skinny white body, they said, "Where?" Because such a child had never before been seen in that place. And then Charlie laughed, and he slipped out from my arms, and I stood up and stayed very still. Behind me, I felt the soft shocks of the soldiers' boots in the sand, and in front of me, all of the local children ran with Charlie down to the crashing water by the rocky point. I felt the hard hand of a soldier on my arm, but I did not turn around. I smiled, and I watched Charlie running away with the children, with his head down and his happy arms spinning like propellers. And I cried with joy when the children all began to play together in the sparkling foam of the waves that broke between worlds at the point. It was beautiful.
And that is a word I would not need to explain to the girls from back home. And I do not need to explain to you, because now we are all speaking the same language. The waves still smashed against the beach, furious and irresistible. But me, I watched all of those children smiling and dancing and splashing one another in salt water and bright sunlight. And I laughed and laughed and laughed until the sound of the sea was drowned.
Little Bee was written by Chris Cleave and read by Anne Flosnick. Michael Noble was the associate producer. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. Little Bee was produced by Tantor Media. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Little Bee is available in print from Simon & Schuster. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Incendiary by Chris Cleave, read by Tracy Ann Oberman, and Gold by Chris Cleave, read by Amelia Fox.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.